Everybody, I'm in my usual mode of just panic and rushing around this morning, but Nathan obviously is out of town, and he had asked me to if I'd be ready to fill in, and I said, I'll be ready as I ever would be, so here we are. If you'll turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, we'll be looking at the latter half of that chapter. I take that on faith because that's what Nathan told me, so I hope that's where you are and ready to begin. And I've made certain accommodations today because we have some visitors with us who don't understand as much English, so if you'll bear with me. So I've gone ahead and put the verses up here in Russian, so they can follow along. So let's go ahead and read the text and get that before us. Now, in giving the following instruction, I do not praise you. Now, remember that because you're going to hear that again. Because you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear there are divisions among you. In part, I believe it. For there must, in fact, be divisions among you, so that those of you who are approved may be evident. Now, when you come together, you're not really eating the Lord's Supper. For when it's time to eat, everyone proceeds with his own supper. One is hungry, and another becomes drunk. Do you not have houses so that you can eat and drink? Or are you trying to show contempt for the church of God by shaming those who have nothing? What should I say to you? Should I praise you? I will not praise you for this. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night in which he was betrayed, took bread, and after he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, he also took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this every time you drink it in remembrance of me. For every time you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. For this reason, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. A person must first examine himself, and in this way he must eat the bread and drink of the cup. For the one who eats and drinks without careful regard for the body eats and drinks condemnation against himself. That's why many of you are weak and sick, and quite a few are dead. But if we examine ourselves, we would not be condemned. But when we're judged by the Lord, we're disciplined so that we may not be condemned with the world. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, he must eat at home, so that when you assemble, it does not lead to condemnation, and I will give directions about other matters when I come. Well, obviously, this section gives us some instruction about the Lord's Supper. It's kind of Paul's example or account of the Lord's Supper. We get accounts of the institution of the Lord's Supper in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and now we have a version from the Apostle Paul as well. Now, if I were to put this in the context of 1 Corinthians, I'd say this is another example of Corinthian freedom, their understanding of freedom in Christ, which basically means what? If you were to ask your typical Corinthian Christian, what does freedom in Christ mean to you?
Do whatever I want.
Do whatever I want. And that sounds very similar to what other philosophy? Yeah, that's true. That's kind of the slogan of American culture, isn't it? Just do what you want to do, as long as you don't hurt anyone else. You know, trample on their freedom to indulge themselves. So this is another example of the kind of where this notion of freedom has taken the Corinthians. I mentioned a long time ago when I filled in for Nathan toward the beginning that the whole book is filled with some rather heated language from Paul because of the strained relationship between Paul and the Corinthians. And there are only a couple of places where this lets up much at all. And one of these is the head covering passage. You don't get any of this kind of heated rhetoric like you do in the rest of the book. Well, this returns to that. You get a lot of sarcasm. You know, am I going to praise you about this? No, I'm not going to praise you. And it's like, you know, when you come together, you're not taking the Lord's Supper. You know, you think you are. That's what you claim you're doing. That's not what you're doing. And, you know, it's why you're sick. It's why you're dead. You know, so It's a pretty strong language. Also, this is one of the places in the book where it becomes clear that the brethren are divided, but what they're divided over is money. Some people have more than others do. It's not as if they're divided over the question of premillennialism or some other, you know, divorce and remarriage or some other doctrine. They're divided over money. There's some questions that we have. First of all, this meal that Paul is talking about, was this a separate meal, or was this part of the Lord's Supper, or actually transforming the Lord's Supper into a common meal? What exactly was going on? I don't know that we can know that specifically, what they were thinking. And then, how were the Corinthians misbehaving themselves? For example, were the people being segregated? And this has been suggested by a number of people. It's obvious that a lot of the early churches met in people's homes. And even when you look at wealthy Romans in the first century, the dining room, what they called the triclinium, would hold about 9 to 12 people. And everybody else would have to eat in the courtyard or the atrium, which might hold 30 to 50 people. And that's kind of a big house, you know. So the upper limits of some of these churches must have been maybe not much bigger than we are as a congregation if they're meeting in somebody's home like that. And of course, we know that culturally, when Romans gave parties, the uppity people ate in the dining room and the lower classes ate out in the courtyard. So was that same kind of thing happening at Corinth? Well, of course, we don't know, but since that was common in their culture, it wouldn't be hard to imagine. Was the food being segregated by portion? Well, that's alluded to by Paul. Apparently, the poor people don't have anything, and so they go hungry, and those who have means can, you know, glut themselves. And then what about the quality of food? You know, the wealthier you are, you get better food, and everybody else gets, you know, cheaper cuts of meat or no meat at all or something like that. Well, to kind of illustrate the point, there is an ancient writer named Juvenal who himself was not on the lower rungs of Roman society, but he critiqued this kind of approach. And so he said, since I'm asked to dinner, why is it not the same dinner served to me as to you? You know, why don't I get the same food you do? You take oysters fattened in the Lucrine Lake. I suck a mussel through a hole in the shell. You get mushrooms. I get hog funguses. You tackle turbo, and I get brill. Golden with fat, a turtle dove gorges you with its bloated rump. And there is set before me a magpie that's died in its cage. Why do I dine without you, Ponticus, although I'm dining with you? Let us eat the same fare. So here's a complaint from a person who, he wasn't on the A list of the guest list, and so he was having to eat some of the lesser quality stuff. Well, you see, we would never do this in America. You know, if you have people over, even if they're of a different economic level than you are, you might even put on a meal that you wouldn't ordinarily eat yourself, but you wouldn't serve some people some food and other people get different food. We just don't do that. If you don't want to serve some people or those kind of people, you just don't invite them. So we have this very kind of democratic American way of, you know, we all eat the same food. Well, they didn't. This was one way of reminding people of the proper pecking order and who's at the top and who's at the bottom. Well, we get another perspective on this from Pliny. And Pliny, of course, he's at the top of the rung, so he gets to enjoy the privilege, but he is still able to critique it. It would take too long to go into the details of how I happen to be dining with a man, though no particular friend of his, whose elegant economy, as he called it, seemed to me a sort of stingy extravagance. The best dishes were set in front of himself and a select few, including Pliny, and cheap scraps of food before the rest of the company. He'd even put the wine into tiny little flasks divided into three categories, not with the idea of giving his guests an opportunity of choosing, but to make it impossible for them to refuse what they were given. One lot was intended for himself and us, another for his lesser friends. All of his friends are graded, and his and our freedmen. So here, the dinner had three levels of society, and so you had three levels of quality of wine, and the top level got the top wine, and the bottom level got the bottom wine, and so on. Well, that again, we don't know that's what's happening at Corinth, but it is kind of eye-opening to realize that their culture behaved this way. And again, it's not difficult to imagine that some of the Corinthians may have simply been following the way things are done in our culture and bringing this over into the Lord's church. And so if we're going to get together and have a meal in Corinth, well, those of us that are wealthy and noble, and you can see how people can justify that, because who made me wealthy and noble? Well, God, you know. So obviously God likes me better than he does this poor person, and so on. And so I shouldn't shy away from the privileges that God has given me for my station in life. Well, Paul, of course, will completely contradict this whole approach. So I would break down the text in kind of these four parts in something of an ABBA pattern, because in the first section, verses 17 through 22, this is the problem. The rich people particularly are addressed by Paul as shaming the poor, putting the poor down, abusing them. And then he turns his attention to what is the meaning of the Lord's Supper then. And so you have the kind of the two sides of that. Here's the wrong behavior, and here then is the right meaning that undergirds all of this. And then you have the conclusion, verses 27 through 32, therefore what do you do about this? And the first kind of instruction he gives addresses the meaning. Here's the meaning of the Lord's Supper. You need to understand the meaning of the Lord's Supper and to live by it. And then the last couple of verses, the final instruction that Paul gives, addresses the first problem, how they're treating one another. And so, again, that corresponds to the particular problem that they were having. And Paul had addressed this idea somewhat back in chapter 10 when he talked about the table of demons and so on, and how it is that if you do go to a pagan temple and you participate, there's an involvement together there. And therefore, this is mutually exclusive, because if we're going to be involved with the table of Jesus, we can't be involved with the table of demons. And so he said in verse 17 back in chapter 10, since there's one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Now, I know there's a lot of what we tend to call one-cup churches, and they see some kind of symbolism in the number of pieces of bread you pass around and the number of cups that you pass around. But the one bread that he's talking about isn't one literal piece of bread, because Christians, wherever they are, that are partaking of this one bread, they're not all nibbling on one physical loaf of bread. He's talking about Jesus, ultimately. And to apply this same principle, you know, if you understand the meaning of the body, which is Christ, then that tells you how you are to treat the body, which in this case is the church. And so there's a connection between all of this. And so when we are partaking of the bread as part of the Lord's Supper, we're thinking of Jesus and Jesus' people. And if you have the right idea about Jesus, then it is impossible to mistreat the people of Jesus. If you understand what Jesus did and the meaning of his life and his sacrifice, how then could you turn around and treat your brother with contempt and put him down and abuse the poor and things like that? Well, there's no way you could do that. And so that's the basic, you know, message that Paul is going to convey here in this section. Well, I'm going to pause here, just kind of big picture kind of stuff, and see if you have any questions, comments. You want me? Jane?
Well, I know it's not a direct correlation, but as far as establishing sort of the culture, and I can't remember where the passage is at, but there's a passage that talks about, you know, not taking the seats and the in the better, you know, the better seats or the better tables.
Yeah, the chief seats.
Yeah, so that you're not embarrassed when they ask you, oh, your seat's in the other room.
Right.
You know, but you take the lesser so that, you know, if you're invited up, then, you know, you receive some, you know, honor.
Right.
Is that the same?
Yeah, I think it's a similar, of course, that's Jewish culture, but it just reminds us that just about every culture except Christ's culture has had this notion of segregation of people and treating people differently. And to the extent that our own culture, you know, I wouldn't say American culture is really egalitarian or equal, because, like I said, we just don't invite those people. You know, how many people really would open their homes to anybody and everybody of any social class and so on? So we have our own way of segregating. We just don't do it in their face, you know. But only Christians are the ones that are going to freely welcome and accept people of any status. And so human culture, just the human condition, man's own sinful nature, has always had this kind of segregating attitude. So I think Shane's right about pointing that out.
Is it possible that the divisions here go back to chapter 1, where they were divided into four groups?
Well, we did read about divisions back at the beginning in chapter 1, and there were some degree of the divisiveness that at least had centered around attitudes toward leaders. Again, I think a lot of people envision those groups as being something like, you know, we're the Paul group, and you know, Paul has a certain brand of doctrine that we're following. You know, we try to interpret that chapter in terms of Baptists and Presbyterians and Methodists or something like that. I think that's probably not what was going on there. And again, if you read the text closely, it's I am of Paul, not we are of Paul. And so you can't even make much of a group identity for those people, as much as just this individualistic, you know, kind of thing that was going on. So, but certainly some divisions that were there. And again, how much of that was because of social status or something, you know, we don't know. It is clear here, though, that money and social status is what was really at play. Well, that's a good question, and we're going to come back and address some of those things here toward the end, perhaps. Just let me know if we actually get around to answering your question specifically. But it does raise an interesting question here in terms of how widespread is this problem? You know, we don't read about it at Ephesus or somewhere else, but it could very well be likely that other congregations had the same struggles with overcoming their culture and trying to drag a lot of the world and its ways of doing things and its philosophy into the church. Corinth certainly did that to more degree than any other congregation that we know about, but it probably was not unusual, as if the Corinthians were the only ones that erred, but this again is the place where we see that dealt with. All right, well, let's look at verses 17 through 22, and this again is the practical problem. This is where Paul is addressing this head on and tackling this issue and says, I'm not going to praise you people at all because I hear what's going on and all this division and separation from one another. And there's a sense in which divisions are good because it shows who's trying to do the right thing from those who aren't. That's just all that Paul is saying there, I think. But as we've said, this section, verses 17, verse 22, is bracketed by this refusal on Paul's part to praise them. And of course, that's just a roundabout way of saying, I'm criticizing you. It's not just I'm going to be neutral. I have some rather strong things to say about you that are not praiseworthy. Now, this raises again the specific practical question, was the problem the way that they were assembling? In other words, were they being too individualistic rather than being more cooperative or collective, more assembly-minded, something like that? Or was the problem in their eating, in the way they were eating, that there was just some specific instructions, ways they should have been physically partaking of the Lord's Supper that they were violating, and Paul is addressing that? Or was it in the selfishness and the division that is taking place? And of course, it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. It could be two of these or all three of them rolled up into one. A good passage is verse 21. In your eating, each one takes his own supper first, and one is hungry and another is drunk. So when you come together, each one, and so you say, well, that's the individual aspect of it. Each one's doing their own individual thing. And then he's taking his supper first. He's kind of like the guy who's running to the head of the line and at the buffet line, you know, so he can be first. And he's grabbing his without, you know, waiting on the others. And then he's selfishly, you know, participating in that. So you can see all three of these things at work in verse 21, or understand Paul's words as critiquing any one of those behaviors. Another thing that's interesting is you notice he says in verse 18, in the first place, when you come together, you know, there are divisions. But Paul never gets around to the second place. You know, this is not an orderly piece of writing where Paul has written it out real logically. He seemed to be pretty agitated as he's doing this, you know. It'd be just like a preacher who says, in the first place, and then he gets off on this thing and he never comes around to saying, well, what's your second point? You know, he just, you know, keeps going on. And I think that illustrates the same kind of emotional agitation that Paul has in this section as well. Clearly, verse 20, where he refers to the Lord's Supper, that's in contrast to his own supper in verse 21. So however you understand what's going on here, Paul is saying, I think in essence, you're claiming to take the Lord's Supper, and that's what you're calling it. If you pass out a church bulletin and it has printed on there, it'll say Lord's Supper, you know, and people serving the Lord's Supper. But in reality, it's your own supper. And that's, you know, to mark out Lord's and put own, because it has become your own rather than the Lord's. So that causes you to go back and reflect, well, what does it mean for something to be the Lord's Supper? That may not be a term we stop and think about a lot, but what are we saying when we say this is the Lord's Supper?
The one that he instituted.
Okay, he instituted it?
It belongs to him?
Okay, it's centered on him, focused on him. Okay, characterized by him. And that brings to mind, what is his character, you know, and so on. In just ordinary terms, if we said, well, you know, what'd you think of Jeanette's supper, you know? Well, it's her supper, you know. Whether one she ate or one she prepared, depending on the context. Well, the Lord is the host. He's invited us to his table as his guests, and what he serves is nothing other than himself, and so on. Well, how do we make the Lord's Supper into our own supper? Well, it's no longer focused on him. It's no longer what he did. It's something we've instituted, something, you know, quite different from that. Shane?
Well, and it's a lot of it seems to revolve around this individualistic type thing. Bread and fruit of the vine prepared, you know, for us today. If we all brought our own little containers of food, and we said, well, it's time. partake of the Lord's Supper, so we all, you know, break out our picnic and can start eating, and maybe somebody didn't have enough money to buy what they needed. And so I'm like, well, you know, stinks to be you, you know, but I've got mine. And that's, I mean, to me, that's when I read through this, that's kind of, you know, part of the problem, and each one was bringing his own individual thing. Some of them, you don't even know if they were eating. They were getting drunk, but maybe they were just, you know, drinking their supper,
right. It's hard to say. And again, I think it's kind of hard to relate to this somewhat, because I don't know about you, I think most Americans would feel uncomfortable being in a situation where somebody's just sitting there eating nothing. I think most of us would feel, not that we're doing it for them as much as just so we don't feel awkward anymore, and we want to make ourselves feel better. Some of us might even be motivated to share something with that person. You know, we have pitch-ins where we share our food together. You know, it's not, we don't have a practice of, we're going to have a pitch-in, and, you know, the Robins are going to sit over there in their corner by themselves eating their food, and, you know, the Hamiltons will be over here eating their food, and, you know, if we didn't bring enough, we're sitting over there, and my kids, you know, pining away, you know. But obviously, that kind of thing was happening here. Now, I've heard of peculiar interpretation of verse 20. I remember when I was a kid, the church there at Arch Street had a little tract training young men and how to, you know, lead singing and do the Lord's Supper and different things. And one of the little pet peeves this guy had in his tract was, now when you get up to do this, you don't call it the Lord's Supper. It's not the Lord's Supper. Because, you know, verse 20 says it's not the Lord's Supper. Well, you know, I just think that's one of those bizarre things. It's like, that's not the point. You know, it's, you know, if you'd asked them, they would have said it's the Lord's Supper. But in fact, that's not what it is. And so it's a point that Paul is making is more of a rhetorical point here. So, if you had again asked them, they would claim to be taking the Lord's Supper. In fact, they're not. And then one final point we might make about this, the term that is translated goes ahead or takes his own supper first, pra lambano, in some contexts can have a time element to it. You know, you're doing this before somebody else is. But it doesn't necessarily have a time element to it. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1 is a good example of that. Would someone like to read that passage? I didn't bring my glasses for one. Joy, he went outside.
Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such an one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted.
All right, so did you hear any word in there that had to do with time? Something happening ahead of time, beforehand. Well, it's, you know, is overtaken, you know, in a trespass. Well, not overtaken ahead of time or overtaken before somebody else is overtaken. It's just you grab somebody, I guess you might say. So it may simply be that Paul's saying they're just grabbing their food without particularly talking about, well, he's grabbing his food before somebody else is getting theirs. Now, that would certainly be a very selfish thing, and you could easily envision people doing that. I just mention this because some people, one of the applications they want to make of this passage is to address the question of, like, the second serving of the Lord's Supper, as it's called, on a Sunday evening. And they would, many, and then the Christians of good conscience, conclude that, you know, churches shouldn't be having a Lord's Supper, you know, on a Sunday evening, a second serving of it, because you're not waiting for one another. And we'll talk about that when we get on to verse 33 again. And the other one being that it's wrong for somebody to go ahead of somebody else in time, in sequence. Now again, in practical application, I don't know of anyone who strictly follows this, because, you know, the trays start at the front, and the people in the first rows are taking it before the people, you know, in the latter rows. But I think most people just kind of commonsensically, well, we all know, you know, what that means. We're all taking at the same time within the rough parameters of that. But when you have somebody who's taking it way ahead of somebody else, separated by many hours, you know, see, that's the kind of thing that this passage would forbid. Well, that is, if in fact you could prove absolutely that the time element was what was the focus here, and say that it's wrong ever to take the Lord's Supper, to eat the bread in time long before someone else ate the bread and partaking of the Lord's Supper. But again, I simply point out here, that's not necessarily the case. To make the time element part of that is only a possibility, it's not a certainty. And so that becomes a more thin ice kind of place to base your argument.
See? Well, I don't see how you could determine what's the element of time. You know, is it 10 minutes? Is it
right.
An hour? Is it 2 hours? I mean, at what point does it become
right.
Sin? Dispersed out.
Right.
It all have
one,
to take
two,
exact,
three.
You know, exact same time. Well, Johnny didn't do it at the right time. Let's do it again because
we didn't all
take it at the same time. So we're all guilty. So.
Right.
And
right.
I've often wondered, I mean, this whole thing, you know, with waiting, you know, where they say it's the sin to have it, or it's not right to have it in the evening because you didn't wait. And I said, well, doesn't that make us in the morning the sinners because we didn't wait on the ones in the evening?
Right. Right.
You know, aren't we wrong to take it in the morning and not?
And how long do you wait?
Right.
You know, it's like we're waiting here and, you know, somebody didn't show up, you know, and again. Guy?
Does the word grab suggest poor manners? Or does it suggest me first?
It may just be selfishly just you know, grabbing it up.
So there's no orderliness to it?
Well, you certainly don't get a picture of any orderliness here at Corinth, but whether that's the real problem Paul's concerned with as much as something else might still be the question. So again, I just mention that because that's a point that some people kind of look at. All right, verse 23 through 26 then, we have the theological problem, as I call it here. The practical problem is how they're treating one another. Well, even deeper problem is their understanding of the Lord's Supper. And so, Paul's point is going to be, you need to remember the crucified Christ. Now, he doesn't say it that way here, but he's laid the foundation for this all the way in the beginning of the book. I preach nothing but a crucified Christ. We preach Jesus Christ and Him crucified. So when we come together to partake of the Lord's Supper, what we're remembering is Jesus. Do this in remembrance of me, this Jesus. Well, what Jesus? Well, the Jesus who died. The Jesus who sacrificed Himself, the Jesus who was unselfish. Well, if you're thinking about a Jesus who's unselfish, how could you then turn around and be selfish? If you're thinking about a Jesus who makes a sacrifice, how then can you, you know, not make a sacrifice and instead force your fellow man to be the one making the sacrifice and so on? And so if it's not this, if you're not thinking about the crucified Christ and the meaning of His sacrifice, then the supper is no longer about Jesus at all. And therefore, it's not the Lord's Supper. It has nothing to do with Jesus. It's just some regular, ordinary, worldly, every man for himself meal that you're grabbing and making yourself better than somebody else. And one little side note here, Paul's version of the institutional Lord's Supper is most similar to Luke's account rather than Matthew and Mark's, as if you were to compare them, which is not surprising since Luke spent so much time, you know, as an associate of Paul's. And so what to do next? That is the wrong slide. So what then are we to do? Well, maybe a slide got hidden here, I guess. Because what he said, the first thing you need to do is to discern. You need to understand the meaning of the body. Because if you don't discern the meaning of the body, you eat and drink judgment or condemnation upon yourself. And that's why many of them were spiritually sick and even spiritually dead. But if we exercise proper judgment about the meaning of the body of Christ and the meaning of His death, then we would be unselfish and we would be living the kind of life that we would live. And then the next application is, eat at home, he says, verse 34. If anyone's hungry, he must eat at home, so that you may not come together for condemnation. Well, this is not a geographic distinction. It's not as if he's saying it's a sin to ever eat at McDonald's or at somebody else's house. That's clearly not the case. Paul has already envisioned back in chapter 10 eating at somebody else's house as a guest. We have many examples of people as guests eating with other people. So it's not talking about a physical location where we eat. Rather, he's talking about the distinction between what we do, again, to use the Greek terms, in ekklesia, in the assembly, as a church, versus the phrase he uses here, in oiko, at home, as a family. Not at home in terms of physically where we are, but as a family. So when I'm at McDonald's with my family, I'm functioning in oiko, in a family setting, rather than in the church, as a, being part of the church. And this is just another one of those passages that shows the difference between how we as Christians act or function as part of a church and how we act or function as part of a family. And there is a distinction there. There are certain responsibilities I have as a member of a family, and there are other responsibilities that I have as a member of a spiritual family of the church. And so here's one of these distinctions where it becomes apparent, at least from what Paul says, is the way you're eating, you don't do that when you come together as a church. You can eat that way at home. You know, you're hungry, you're wanting to satisfy your hunger, you're wanting to get your fill, you're wanting to have a regular meal. The place to do that is in the family. That's what families do. In the church, because the church is about spiritual things, we don't do that. The meal that we have is to partake of Christ and focus on Him. Now, there are some physical elements of that that are representative of Christ, since we can't literally gnaw the body of Jesus, and there wouldn't be any point in that anyway. But it is just a physical symbol and reminder that we are partaking of Christ, taking Him into ourself, and therefore He becomes part of us, and we're living out the life of Christ in our life. And of course, you can see all kinds of application with that. I was in a church building just the other day. My kids said, it looks like a mall. Because, you know, there was a coffee shop there with the cash register and all the stuff on display that you could buy, you know, while you're there at church. That's what a church is all about. And here's a very important point that you see in Corinthians. There are many things that the Corinthians were abusing, like spiritual gifts. And when they're taking something good and misusing it, Paul tells them how to fix it. But when it's just wrong, he says, you can't do that. And so he doesn't tell them, for example, you people are misusing your spiritual gifts. Just stop it. You know, I can't take it anymore. You're just messing this all up. Just quit. That's not his solution. His solution is to tell them how to properly use their spiritual gifts. Now they want to go to a pagan idol temple. Oh, you're just not doing that the right way. Let me tell you the right way to go worship at a pagan idol temple. No, he says you can't do that. There's not a right way to, you know, abandon your spouse and go off and leave them, you know. You don't divorce. You know, again, we can get into all kinds of exceptions and things technically, you know, but Paul doesn't address that in chapter 7. So there are things like that, you know, visiting prostitutes back in chapter 6, you know, not abusing that. It's just wrong. Stop it. So if Paul wanted to say, you know, you're abusing this, you're taking a good thing and just doing it the wrong way, it'd be okay to do it as long as you did it the right way, Paul could very well say that. But no, he says, no. No, the place to do this is at home. What we're doing together as a church is not this physically focused taking of a regular meal together. Now, again, that's not to take away from the Lord's Supper and what it is. And I think sometimes the degree to which we maybe go to their extreme and take as microscopically as small a particle of bread as we can and sip as little grape juice might somewhat detract from it. Anyway. And then wait for one another, as we mentioned, really in the Old Testament, that word's translated to accept or to receive or welcome somebody. And even in the New Testament, it can be used of waiting on somebody in terms of time. But again, at other times it isn't. So that's the other passage that people look to and say, see there, it's all about time. Could be, you know, but maybe not. And so again, it's a pretty tenuous passage to base your doctrine on. So I would think those who want to focus on the time element still have some additional things they're going to need to prove their case. I think the focus is probably more on the degree of the self-centeredness and individualism and how it's all about them and not about Christ as really being the root problem. That certainly doesn't address all the issues about the second serving of the Lord's Supper and so on, but we're out of time. So maybe Nathan can address those next week. We know he's not going to. He's going to go right into chapter 12, but we'll leave it at that for today. So thank you.